We're going to continue our series this morning looking at biblical characters, their lives and events, looking at Genesis 22 this morning, and noticing that you need greater hope to do greater things. There's a strong connection in Scripture between faith and hope. Living by faith today is contingent on the ability to live hopefully tomorrow. In the 1990s, the Nebraska Cornhuskers were dominant. They won three national championships in the span of 4 years. They were one of the best teams in the nation year after year after year. And one of the worst teams year after year after year was the Iowa State Cyclones, and they were in the same conference, played each other every year. And it was the week when Nebraska was going to be playing Iowa State, and nobody was under any illusion that Iowa State had the slightest chance. And sure enough, they lost by more than 40 points. Now, typically at Iowa State, before a big game, the university bookstore would put up for sale posters and pennants for the students to carry into the stands during the game. And usually those posters would say things like, "Kill Kansas," or "Mess with Missouri." But the week of the Nebraska game, the posters that were for sale in the bookstore said, "Maintain dignity." not super optimistic. But you know, how do you do that? How are people able to do that? How are they able to maintain dignity when life gets really hard? How are Christians able to live above what pulls so many people under? And the answer is hope. Hope because we're convinced the tomb is empty. And that changes everything. Peter says in 1 Peter 1:3, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." We've been reborn into a new life, a life of hope because of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. So we're able to live above circumstances that pull others under because our hope of eternal life is secure. And if that's true of our tomorrow, then suddenly what we do today really matters. And the reverse is also true. If there's no hope for tomorrow, there's no reason to make a difficult effort today. For example, several years ago up in Maine, there was a little town named Flagstaff. And that town is underwater now. It's a lake by that name. Flagstaff was impounded and the town was flooded. And from the time the dam was finally approved and was under construction, the residents of the little town of Flagstaff had several months, almost a year, warning, knowing that they would have to relocate out of that town, that their town's days were numbered. So what do you think happened to that town during that year? Well, they stopped taking care of it. Roofs that leaked weren't repaired. Fences fell over and were left fallen. The paint weathered and cracked. Weeds broke through the sidewalks. The roads developed huge potholes. Broken windows were taped over but not replaced. Because why care about something today if it's going to be gone tomorrow? You see, what I believe about tomorrow has a powerful impact on how I behave today. So the Bible teaches us that you can't live by faith today if you don't have hope for tomorrow. In the Bible, faith and hope walk hand in hand. A few verses later, Peter says, verse 21, "Through Jesus you believe in God, who raised him from the dead and glorified him. So your faith and hope are in God." We live faithfully today because we live hopefully for tomorrow. Hebrews 11:1 says, "Now faith is confidence in what we hope for, and assurance about what we do not see." And the choices we make today are largely dependent on the hopes we have for the future. And this is especially true when we're considering making a sacrifice. Now, if you're going to ask me to make a huge sacrifice of my time, my talents, my treasures today, then I'll need to have confidence about what's going to happen tomorrow. That leads us to this week's look at a biblical character and event. It's in Genesis 22. It's the story of Abraham offering his son Isaac. Abraham, you know, has waited decades for this promised child to be born. And yet God says in Genesis 22, starting in verse 1, sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." The boy's name is Ishak. It means laughter. And from the time of his birth, this boy has brought laughter into Abraham and Sarah's home. Abraham was an old man when the child was born, and he had ordered his life and his hopes for the future around this boy. He was the center of his existence. And now Abraham is being tested. The Lord wants to know if Abraham's hope is in God or in the boy that God gave him. Now, Abraham lived in a time when other religious men sacrificed their children as a show of devotion to false idols. It was a common thing in that world. And so far, the biblical narrative hasn't revealed Yahweh's disgust with that practice. So when God says, "I want you to sacrifice your son," Abraham doesn't protest. But there's a huge problem here. In addition to the problem of, "But this is my son whom I love," there's the problem of, how can God ask for the child of promise and still keep the promise? What Abraham has to reconcile is what God has said that he wants him to do to Isaac with what God has said he wants to do through Isaac. So the question is, can Abraham step out in faith today to make a radical offering? And what I want you to see is, it was his hope for tomorrow that gave him faith for today. Continuing on in Genesis, early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there." And now notice this, he says, "We will worship and then we will come back to you." And I don't think these are words of unconscious prophecy. I think these are words of unwavering hope. You know, we just read, Abraham got up early the very next morning after God told him to sacrifice Isaac. He got up early the very next morning and loaded up and headed out. But it doesn't say that he slept at all the night before. I mean, surely he spent that night tossing and turning and thinking back to all of the years that had passed since God had called him to leave his homeland. Of all of those times when his faith had been so weak, when he had failed so miserably to be faithful to God, those times he had allowed his fears to lead him into some foolish, destructive, faithless decisions and behavior, but also how God had proven to be faithful to him over and over again. How God had proven that this promise that seemed unattainable, that seemed unbelievable, would actually be fulfilled. He had to think back to the shocking but wonderful news that Sarah was pregnant in her old age, just as God had promised. And the joy that Isaac had brought into their home, and the future plans God had revealed for his own legacy through Isaac. Was he going to give in to fear again? Or was he going to fully trust in God's goodness and faithfulness? He didn't know how God could keep his promises if he sacrificed Isaac, but he decided to trust him. Hebrews 11:19 says about this, he says, "Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death." Now, we know in the Bible there are stories of people rising from the dead. It's happened several different times in the Bible. But never to this point. It has never happened before. And yet Abraham reasoned, God made this promise, and now God is telling me to sacrifice Isaac, and God doesn't lie. So God could even raise the dead. I mean, somehow God will keep his promise. He's told me what tomorrow looks like. And Abraham's absolute hope in tomorrow enabled him today to make a radical sacrifice. So he came to this test of faith with full assurance of his hope. They went up that mountain. Verse 9, continuing, when they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac, laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Going down to verse 15, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." Now, there's so many fascinating aspects to this account. I mean, as I'm reading that and I hear these words, God saying, "Now I know that you fear God because you've not withheld from me your son," I'm thinking, wait a minute, God, doesn't God already know everything you're going to do before you do it? How can he say, "Now I know that you fear God"? I mean, didn't God already know what Abraham was going to do? And that's another topic to consider on another day. But consider, this is the first time Isaac heard God articulate the promise. Now, he's heard all of his life his daddy talk about it. He's heard his daddy tell the story so many times about that night, a long time before Isaac had even been thought about. That night when God had asked Abraham to look up at the sky and try to count the stars. Have you ever been out in the desert, a long way from civilization, on a night with no moon, and looked up at the sky? It's staggering. There's hardly a dark spot in it. The stars cover the sky. It's amazing, beautiful sight. You don't see that here in Louisville. We see like 3 or 4 stars. But out in the desert, you see thousands and thousands of stars. And God said to Abram, "That's what your offspring is going to be. Countless." Isaac's heard his daddy talk about this. But this is the first time Isaac heard God talk about it. You see, Abraham didn't just pass the faith test. He also tutored his son. His unquenchable hope became a teachable moment for Isaac. Because here's the thing about hope. It cannot be dispensed until it's first displayed. You cannot pass hope on to the next generation by giving a book to read about it or a video to watch. Hope has to be experienced before it's owned. This is critical because you and I both want the next generation to be filled with hope. We want them to be guided by faith. And we have an opportunity to show our children by our own sacrifices today how certain we are that God will come through tomorrow. So don't just keep your commitments to God. Make commitments to God. Say you will. And if you tell your children your hope is in God, but you never demonstrate a sacrificial faith commitment to God, then your words are going to fall on deaf ears. Don't we want children who are worshipers instead of worriers? It's like the man who bought a hummingbird feeder because he noticed a hummingbird in his neighborhood. He put one out in his backyard, and he and his family were delighted because immediately a bunch of hummingbirds showed up to feed there, sometimes 3 or 4 at one time. He wound up, because his feeder was so popular, having to refill that feeder every day. But over time, he noticed that he was seeing fewer and fewer birds, so that he only had to fill it about once a week, and he couldn't figure out why. So one day he decided to watch closely and try to figure out why. And he found that there was a relatively large male hummingbird that had taken possession of that feeder. That bigger hummingbird would fly around all day long watching, and if any other bird came near, he would dive bomb them and drive them away. It was his domain. It was his feeder, but at a cost. That bird could never afford to lose sight of that feeder. He couldn't fly anywhere else or do anything else, but just watch over that feeder all day long, every day. He had to live 24/7 worried about his feeder. His possession became his prison. And that's exactly what's happening in our culture. We're living in bondage to stuff. And Jesus warned about what would happen if we let that happen. He said that you will worry. You will worry. You will worry. And not for 4 years or 40 years or 400 years, but for 4,000 years, worshipers have worshiped God with hands held like this. Empty hands. One of the basic messages people have communicated for 4,000 years by holding up empty hands is that worshipers cannot be clutchers. It's the example Jesus gave us when he didn't count equality with God something to be clutched, something to be grasped, but he emptied himself. And that's the path we're all called to follow. Worshipers cannot be clutchers. And Abraham's whole life has been a series of this. Let go of your home. Let go of your country. Let go of your family. Let go of Lot. Let go of Ishmael, your flesh, your own flesh. Let go of your timetable of when God's promises ought to be fulfilled. So when you see this man ascending that mountain, you do not see a beaten down, fearful man. You see a man on his way to worship. He's learned what worship is. Now, this is the first time the word worship is found in the Bible. The first time. The first time it's used in the New Testament is in Matthew 2, when wise men come from the east bringing gold and frankincense and myrrh to give. And they say, "Where's the child we have come to worship?" Worship at its essence is bringing God an offering. It's the willing and joyful sacrifice of myself that springs out of a heart that's full of hope in God. And isn't that what we want for our children? Do we really want them to grow up believing that to be happy, they need closets bursting with stuff? Because if that's what we teach them, when life gets hard, they're going to go under. Because the thing we've told them that will make them happy is something that is constantly susceptible to loss. And if that's what we believe, we will spend our days like that hummingbird, hovering over and over, worried that we will lose what we've got and wondering how we can get more. And we'll be in a prison of our own making. What our children need is hope. And if we're going to teach our kids how to hang on, we've got to teach them how to let go, because we want them to be worshipers instead of warriors. We want them also to know God as a reality. In that moment on the mountain was the day the Father's God became real to the Son. That was the day that the God Abraham talked about became the God Isaac knew for himself. And the memory of his father's faith put into action taught Isaac more than 1,000 sermons could have ever done. So let me ask you, what stories are our kids going to tell their kids when life gets tough about the things they learned about hope when they were children? What stories are our kids going to teach their kids about what they learned from us about hope? What stories of sacrifice will they tell? Max Lucado writes, he says, "One of the earliest memories I have of my father from when I was old enough to read and old enough to get bored in church, I was sitting at home and I found his pocketbook. It had a check stub in it and a check ledger. And what I remember was that there was a series of checks written to the Andrews Church of Christ, not just one, but all the way down the page. and the next page, and the next page, and the next page. And only later, he says, would I learn his practice of sitting down the first day of the year and writing 52 contribution checks. The money wasn't there. He would wait until the day came and the checks were post-dated. But he put those checks in a drawer so that on Sunday morning, he wouldn't forget, he wouldn't be tempted not to give. He didn't make a lot of money. I don't know what the amount was. But do you think I caught something? He never sat down and gave me a lecture on being a steward, but he gave me a lesson. And I don't remember many sermons. I'm not sure I remember any sermons from my youth. But I do remember going along with Dad on visits to the nursing home. I remember our family taking food to poor families on Thanksgiving so they could have a Thanksgiving meal. I remember my parents answering God's call to go to Africa in the mid-1960s, moving themselves and their two young children away from family and friends and country and culture to spread the gospel in a strange land. And I have a vivid memory of my mother sitting on the porch in Africa with a long line of people in front of her and her going each person and cleaning their wounds and bandaging them and telling me one morning to go get my best pair of jeans out of a drawer and bring them so she could give them to a little boy who was standing in front of her with clothes in tatters. Hope dispensed must first see hope displayed. And the best promise we could make to our kids is that we're going to live in hope ourselves. Because we want our kids to know God as reality, not just a thought, not just a theory, not a philosophy, a reality, a person. Abraham was a fearful, sinful man, just like we are. But his faith journey led him to completely put his hope and trust in God, to the point that he passed a test of faith that boggles the mind of every single father who ever hears that story. So now, Abraham is not just the father of many nations. He's the father of faith. Paul says in Romans 4:16, therefore the promise comes by faith, so that it may be grace by grace and may be guaranteed to all Abraham's offspring, not only to those who are of the law, but also those who have the faith of Abraham. Abraham is the father of us all, Paul says. He's your father if you're faithful. He's my father if I'm faithful. So follow in your father's footsteps. Put your hope in God. Walk by faith. Trust God. Put it into practice and pass on a legacy of hope and faith to the next generation. If you're ready to begin that faith journey this morning, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing.